Welcome to the Norris Group's Real Estate Radio Show. Hosted by author, investor, hard money lender, and real estate educator, Bruce Norris. Equipping California real estate professionals for tomorrow's challenges.
Hi, thank you for joining us. My name is Bruce Norris, and today we have a special guest, John Bohannon. He is one of the partners in BuildZig, and he has a lot of experience in the builder control industry. He's owned a company called Builder Control, Inc., a funds disbursement company. He evaluated and inspected thousands of construction projects from single family to large subdivisions to commercial buildings. And since we're in the phase that looks like we're going to have more new construction, I thought it'd be great to talk to you to him. So, John, welcome to our show.
Thank you for having me.
You know, you're almost on the forefront of before it happens, because the services that your company provides isn't looking at just what's existing and what's being built. It's projects that are ready to be coming on the map. So let's talk a little bit about that first. What do you see for 2014 that might be different than 2012 and 13?
Well, we're definitely seeing more ground-up construction, and specifically in the higher-end single-family home. This has been a slow churn from the fix and flips that kind of rebooted the real estate cycle in California anyway, and projects got bigger and more expansive in the fix and flip arena, and then it got so saturated with competition, people just started looking for a different product, and it naturally has evolved into the higher end single family home construction. So that's what we're seeing for this year.
Okay, you're seeing more of a, now these are still spec, but they're higher end spec, or they already purchased and they're just building about after they were.
But in our case, it's all spec.
Okay. Okay. Now, as far as, do people come to you for other services related to, let's look at a piece of land, you know, what do we do with this? What's the general feeling out there from the contractors you deal with on their maybe level of optimism and their level of activity going forward?
Well, I would say the general feeling is very positive. Everyone feels good about where we're going for this year. There are some constraints. The labor market is tightening up in construction. There is inflation in material supplies. Large construction projects, we are seeing the inflation line item being put back into budgets. So, and they're running at about 3.3% on a yearly basis. So that they just acknowledge the fact that whatever price we say today, by the end of this project, we're probably spending about 3% more on material supplies and labor. So, you know, it's a positive mood, but they are being conservative and trying to plan for higher costs, tighter labor markets. But we typically work for lenders, and lenders always like to find the safe haven. Capital always gets directed to where lenders feel it's most safe or comfortable. And just like the typical cycles we see is fix and flip is very popular, then it turns into single family ground up construction, then it moves on to a larger tract development, then into multifamily, and then condominiums are very popular, and then the market crashes and we start all over again.
And then you turn your condo project to an apartment building.
That's right. So that's like the typical cycle. And you understand the cycles better than I do. What I'm suggesting, this is the cycle we see of the flow of money from one safe haven to the next. This is where lenders say, we don't do ground-up construction. They said that last year. Now they're saying, well, you know, we're going to start to do that.
But that's kind of a different animal than let's take this piece of land and turn it into building lots. There aren't too many, from what you're saying, lenders are not so excited about that yet.
That's right. Okay. We haven't got there. There are lots of great deals on raw land right now, but finding the capital to make that something is very difficult. And so if one is so inclined and has the resources, it would probably be at the perfect propitious timing for that type of building product. But just finding the capital that is willing to go there with you is very difficult. So we're seeing all of it really in fix and flip still, but it's starting to switch over into the single-family ground-up construction.
And you kind of said that most of that was seeming to be higher end than median price, let's say.
Well, that's right.
Okay.
I think production builders pretty much take care of the average median type price home. And then on the speculation basis, people that would be going to hard money lenders, private money lenders, they would be looking at the higher end.
Do you think most of what's being constructed in, let's say, Riverside County is being constructed on lots that existed prior to, say, 2010?
Yeah, that does seem to be the case right now.
Okay.
Yes.
That's one of the things that's interesting. You know, you're going to be at the forefront of how the things change because of what your company does, and we ought to talk a little bit about that. Because when I look at a chart, I can say that the creation of subdivisions is still down from what's normal by over 90% in Riverside. So you have a developer that or a builder that should probably be able to sell anything they can build, but they're not going out there creating a new building lot. So those seem to be on the opposite ends of the spectrum, where they're not creating the building lots, but they'd be happy to build something and probably can make a profit on it.
Well, that's right. And we create our own artificial demand for product that doesn't necessarily have to be there if capital was willing to invest in subdivision and mapping new lots right now. But it just isn't.
Okay. In the house buying business, you know, we make decisions to buy a house inside of minutes. If I use that time frame when buying land projects, how would that work out for me?
Well, you really want to find out what is the demand for wherever this land is. I mean, you can look at any piece of land and say, oh, let's build a subdivision there, but, you know, will it actually have any buyers? So the first thing is, you know, what does this particular land mass in this area need the most of. It is supply and demand in that regard. But then you're limited by the zoning and the master plan of the community. So just because you can look at a piece of dirt and say, hey, this would be great for homes, doesn't mean you can build homes there. And you can always make exceptions, but anytime you fall outside of a predetermined zoning plan that the city has already spent a lot of time and money to put together, you're going to take it's going to take you a long time and a lot more money and consulting dollars to bring that into a final subdivision map. So you really just you've got to understand what the area needs, and then you got to find out what it's zoned for, and those usually meet up exactly where they should, where the city has already thought that this is an area we really want to see industrial parks, for example. We don't want homes here. We want homes way over here where they'll be kind of out of the way and not bothered by, you know, high traffic flow. So that's you usually find that they meet. I mean, there's some thought put into those zoning plans, and you want to build homes where it's one, zone that way, and two, where there's a market for those homes.
Cities kind of map these things out probably many years in advance. So for them to want to change a usage, there would have to be a surprise need that they didn't think of 10 years ago.
Well, that's right. And cities do change and alter over time. But for the most part, you know, they've thought this out. It's part of the master plan community. They want residents in a certain zone, an office in a certain zone, and industrial in another zone. And the idea of changing that are getting the rights to build anything on a piece of dirt. That is what we call the entitlement process. And the entitlement process used to be very simple. It's go into the city and say, hey, can I build this here, and pay a fee and get the plans reviewed and you're off and running. But now this is a very complex process that involves multiple consultants, from civil engineer to geotechnical engineer. You've sometimes are forced into what they call an environmental impact report, EIR, and those have various nuances of phase 1, 2, and even 3. So all of this takes a lot of time and a lot of money, and again, the capital does not feel safe there. It rarely ever feels safe there. Talking traditional lenders, banks, investment firms, they do not like taking that sort of market risk. They're leaving it up to other people, usually production builders, for example. They're taking that risk on, and not until they have a final map recorded and you're good to build does kind of mainstream capital feel comfortable in investing. By that point, you know, you're just building homes.
Sometimes I'm speaking and someone will come up to me at the end of my talk and they say, okay, I've heard about this piece of land and I need to close it in 3 days, you know, and it looks like a good deal. And there's never a time where I've said that's probably something you should write a check for. Because of what you said, there's so many things that get in the way of that being successful that really don't come into play with a single family house.
Well, that's right, and they always follow that statement, too, by, you know, it's only 25% loan-to-value, so it's just the best piece of dirt ever. But, yeah, how do you put value on land? Now, big builders, production builders, for example, they're very critical about the residual land value of any dirt they do. The residual is the implied meaning of the word is, what is the land worth after we spend all the time and money to get it mapped, build a house, and sell it? After we do all of that and take our expected 8% profit, what's left over? That's the residual land value. So to come up with a value of a piece of dirt that has no vested rights or entitles or anything, or even a real conception of what could be done there, is pretty impossible, actually. That's what always cracks me up. Is they always say, it's 25% loan to value. And I'm like, well, how do you know that? That may not be good enough. We saw during this downturn, we had plenty of production builders with subdivisions on their books, and the residual land value was negative.
Correct. You couldn't have penciled anything.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah.
Well, we know a few hard money lenders that had loans on those things, too. And it goes back to your point. It's not the easiest thing to get loans for or money for because it takes a real expertise and it takes a market that's cooperating. And I think that's one of the problems with developers is that you still are way below the numbers of 06, 07. And when somebody has a piece of land for sale, you go through all the costs, No, if you're talking about 8%, that can disappear into the woodwork pretty quickly.
Indeed.
Do you consider when somebody calls you up, and let's talk a little bit about the services that you offer. So I call you up and I say, I've got a parcel of land, 5 acres. I think I'm going to finally do something about it. You come out and probably you've already checked and, okay, this is the usage that the city wants this to turn into. Is there a thought about the history of the parcel at that point, you know, what's been here before?
Oh, yeah. I would say that's a fairly newer consideration, but because of all the lawsuits and environmental impact reports and the costs and the time it takes to do this, now the prior use of the land becomes a very critical question to ask. You know, was there a gas station on here? Was there an old industrial building that had a waste dump site on here? Just because you can't see it doesn't mean it's not there. Does the land have water rights? I mean, is it going to be a problem to bring in water? So the past use for the dirt is a more important question than ever now, and you have to ask it, and you have to know what's there. I can give you a horrifically funny, sad story. Funny because not me, but we had a gentleman out in Riverside County in the Temecula area of the county of Riverside that, I think 10, 20 acre lot.
Right.
And he had a bulldozer, so he bulldozed a nice big hole in the ground and filled it up with water, and he called it the kids' pond. And that was there for, 5-6 years, and the kids loved it. And somehow it got mapped on the geo maps, and it became a blue line stream that got recorded on the books. And so when he went to do something to his own property, fill the hole back up, and he wanted to build something there, they refused to allow him. And they said, if you want to do that, you're going to have to do an environmental impact report as to what was there and what happened. And this was just a pond he dug himself.
Mm-hmm.
So Yeah, you really got to be careful. And what sometimes can look like a dry river bank is, in fact, possibly a dry river bank, and it is mapped out as a blue line stream that you can't build around or near or on, and messes up your density count for, you know, for single family homes, as an example. That's hard to overcome those financials.
If he told that story, would common sense kick in as to what he had to do, or is it go back to regulation and say, you're going to be really sorry he did that?
Yeah, regulation wins, and he was sorry he did that. So,
why is that where it lands? Just honestly, I'm curious sometimes.
Well, it's just the environment and all the lawsuits that we have to deal with now.
Okay.
In every industry, not just construction. But I would say construction is very litigious and probably a little more common in this industry than others.
One of the things that I read that you are an expert witness on occasion.
Yes. Yes.
So what, give me an example of when that comes up.
Well, a lot of times it comes up over the misappropriation of construction holdback lands.
Okay.
And what that really means is it all comes back to a landmark case in 1976 with the Standard Insurance Company versus Bank of America. And the judge wrote this beautiful case law summary. And he basically said the little background here is the insurance company provided a completion bond for a subdivision, and Bank of America was construction lender. And the Bank of America was releasing progress payments to the contractor from time to time as work was done. And it came to a point where the project was not completed. The money was out, and the city went after the bond, the insurance company, for this completion bond and said, you need to get out here and you need to finish this project. That's why we got a completion bond. Well, the insurance company said no, and they're very good at that. They always know right away, and then, you know, after a long, drawn-out battle, then they finally perform. But in this case, they said no, and they sued Bank of America. And Bank of America, the case ruling that came out of here was said the burden was on the bank to make sure that the money being released was congruent with the amount of work being done. And the judge went on further to say that this burden is not substantial, easily be done by doing site inspections and verifying that the work is in fact done and making sure that it is commensurate with the amount of money you're releasing. So basically ever since then, we've had this system in place, which is called, for lack of a better term, as an industry, we call it funds control.
Mm-hmm.
Funds control is when the lender makes a construction loan, they have a holdback amount for construction, and that could be any amount. But they close the loan, and then there's just money sitting aside somewhere. And what happens is the contractor starts work, he completes work, he fills out a draw request and says, I've done, you know, X, Y, and Z. Or let's say he's done the foundation and the framing is halfway done. So there would be an inspector that would go out to the site and confirm that the foundation is done and that framing is 50% complete. And if, in fact, it was, then they would go ahead and authorize the release of those funds to the contractor. But if it wasn't, now we have proof, and now we can say, no, you're not there yet. You're only 25% done with framing, so we're only going to give you that much. And that's become the funds control process, and it's just stemmed out of that case law from 1976. So that's the right way to do construction loans for the benefit and protection of not just the investor, but the lender of record and the contractor. We don't want to get them too much money. They get ahead of themselves, and then they're hard to find.
Well, they also borrow from projects to finish other projects.
Right.
So
that's right.
You're preventing that. Okay. Now, the person inspecting has some expertise in what he's looking at?
Yeah, and there's a new rule in California that started last year. It's called SB 978. And what came out of that rule is in part a reaction to the downturn and what happened. We had a lot of lenders out there that made financial commitments for construction and did not have the money. So the contractor would submit a draw request, and the lender would say, sorry, I don't have it. And so, you know, you take a project that's is already in deep trouble because of market condition, and now it can't even get completed because there's no additional dollars to complete it. So, you know, this SB 978 basically said, look, if you're going to fund a loan and you're going to do, you know, private money transaction here, we want you to fully fund the loan up front. You know, if it's a $1 million loan and only $200,000 is for construction, guess what? You got to fully fund that loan, and you got to take that $200,000. And by the way, lender, we don't trust you anymore because you really hurt us in the downturn. So we're going to make you put it with an independent third party. So we don't even trust you with the money. So raise it all up front, close escrow, send it to somebody else, and then make sure we have a qualified individual perform inspections. Now, they give a slight definition of what qualified is, and you know that says an engineer, an architect, a licensed contractor, or other qualified inspector. That's what they say, but that's it's a vague definition. But the idea is, you know, can you look at a set of plans and can you walk on a job site and actually see what's in front of you and understand what it is? I mean, can you make a determination whether the framing is 50% done or 75% done? If you can do that, then you're qualified.
Okay. And in most cases, the owner of the property, I mean, if he's a general contractor, then he probably understands what he's looking at and can protect himself. But a lot of times, that's not the case. The person that has the project isn't the expert. They're hiring somebody, and when they say they need money, if they didn't have a fund control, they'd just be writing a check.
Well, that's right. And actually, we see a long tradition of individual consumers that get a bank loan to build their dream house. And things get ahead of themselves, and then all of a sudden they're coming to a private money lender and asking them, begging them to give them enough money to finish the job. And chances are that that's happened because the contractor was advanced too much money. And you know, regardless of what people think of private money has been a staple for contractors in California forever. And they are the ones that actually help the individual build buildings. So they're there, and they've gotten pretty smart on this, and they all use funds control in some form or fashion, whether it's a company like BuildZig or some other company. They want to make sure that the money that's being released is actually being put into the project. And thus, as the holdback amount decreases, the increased equity value of the project goes up. So they're matched up very well. So if you've got a $100,000 holdback and you've spent $50,000 of it, then the property should be worth at least $50,000 more because of the work done on the site.
Correct. How many inspections would a city do to get to a final, and compare that to how many inspections might be done by fund control?
Well, city inspectors, they're all good. They have a set schedule of when to go out there. Those are major milestones. So, for example, before you pour foundation, they want to inspect to make sure that, you know, the forms are right, the right rebar is being used, the spacing on is right, is there a vapor barrier, things like this. They got all those questions down. So they look for that, and then they allow you to pour. And so then you would come back when the framing is done, and they check to make sure it was done to the plans and specs and everything. So you can see the pattern. It's every major milestone, so foundation, framing.
How many of those would be in the project, let's say?
You're looking at about 8.
Okay. John, we're almost out of time, so I want to mention your company again, BuildZig. What is the website?
You can go to buildzig.com.
Okay. And lots of information there on the different services that they have. And we're going to join John Bohannon in another segment and talk a little bit about distressed projects, taking them on in the middle, like we almost just started. John, thanks for being with us today.
My pleasure.
You've been listening to the Norris Group Real Estate Radio Show. For more information on the Norris Group, please visit www.thenorrisgroup.com.